Hey, everyone. Just a reminder that because this season of The City is about strip clubs, it won't be suitable for everyone, especially kids. This episode contains explicit language, including explicit conversations about sex.
Previously on The City,
the destination is downtown Reno. They want a little bit naughty. They want some nice.
We are truly rebranding this city, and companies like Tesla, Amazon, and Apple are all building and investing right here.
I think there's just certain people that just do not like what we do.
Because I think it's an embarrassment to our community. And it's something that I believe we should have done something about a long time ago.
They have a gold mine there. We've all tried to buy it.
I've had guys give me condoms before, and I tell them I can't do that. Like, I'm sorry.
There's no records, there's no reports, there's nothing. So what do? Lie.
You had informed me that staff had commissioned a private investigator to go into all of the licensee holders and observe activities there.
I'm being persecuted, and the worst thing to do is get angry and do something stupid. I just wait. There'll be a time when I get my revenge.
Velma Scholes has trouble sitting still. The 64-year-old grandmother spends her days darting up and down the hallways of the Ponderosa, the six-story hotel attached to the back of the Wild Orchid Strip Club. The movement helps stave off depression, which is so bad that Velma gets disability payments for it. But it's not aimless wandering. She uses that time to check on her neighbors, who she looks out for with the watchful eye of a den mother. Velma's one of more than 100 people who pay week to week to live at the Ponderosa. As for the strip club next door, Velma doesn't mind it. But living at the Ponderosa does come with its frustrations and indignities. The neighbor who disappeared without notice, leaving his room so dirty it became infested with roaches. Or the men Velma saw stealing AC units from the building. And then there was the letter she found tacked to her door one day last winter.
Okay, this is the letter we received on our doors. It said, to all Ponderosa hotel tenants. Unfortunately, I must relay some bad, very bad news to you.
The letter was from Cammy Kashmiri. Remember, he and his family owned both the strip club and the hotel. And the note warned Velma and her neighbors that their rent might be going up by a lot.
We are aware that many, if not most, of you living on fixed incomes, collecting Social Security, disability, unemployment, and or veterans benefits. With that in mind, we have always strived to keep your rents low.
Cammy goes on to say that he's been able to keep the rent low because he uses money from the strip club to subsidize the Ponderosa. But things have changed. Now, Reno City Council members are openly talking about tougher regulations for the strip clubs, maybe even forcing them to move. And Cammy's letter to Velma and her neighbors makes clear that if that happens, he might have to nearly double their rent, from around $750 to around $1,300 a month.
There ain't no way in the world, $1,300? Who's got that kind of money? Nobody. Ugh, that's a lot of money.
But Cammy has a suggestion for how his tenants might stave off this rent increase. Go talk to your rep in city council, he writes. He even includes a list of their phone numbers.
Perhaps you can stop the city from gentrification of the Wild Orchid at the expense of your homes. You have my sincere apologies for this bad news.
Velma and her granddaughter have nowhere else to go. This is the only stable place they've had to live in almost a decade. And she'll do anything to keep it. So by sending that letter, Cammy has effectively conscripted some of the city's most vulnerable residents as foot soldiers in his fight to save his strip clubs. Velma and her neighbors are now embroiled in this fight too, whether they like it or not. From USA Today, I'm Robin Amer, and this is The City.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
So at the end of our last episode, the Reno City Council had just drawn battle lines for its fight against the clubs, including Cammies. They voted to pursue new laws that would force the clubs to stop serving alcohol, take down any digital signs, and eventually move out of downtown altogether. We also learned that Reno City Attorney Carl Hall had secretly hired a private eye to dig up dirt on the clubs, dirt the city could use to bolster its case. Now, Carl Hall had publicly refused to release the report, but our reporter Anjanette Damon wouldn't take no for an answer. Here's Anjanette.
Carl Hall had refused to give me the report, so I wrote a story about it, and the Reno Gazette Journal's lawyer threatened legal action. The city manager overruled Carl Hall and released the report the next day. Whether it was being called out by the paper or our lawyer threatening to sue that ultimately did it, I don't know. Either way, I finally got my hands on the report. To give you a sense of what was in it, of what Carl Hall found from his secret surveillance, I want to take you back to the three nights in early February 2017 when the PIs first went into Reno's strip clubs. Just a heads up, it gets kind of racy. Picture this. A team of private investigators fans out through downtown Reno. They post up outside two of Reno's sex toy shops and five of its strip clubs, including all three of Cammie's clubs. They count every person walking into the clubs, and they note any bad behavior, rowdiness, swerving vehicles, that kind of thing. At Fantasy Girls, one PI watches as a guy walks out of the club, gets in a car with another guy, and then goes back into the club a few minutes later. Could it be a drug deal? They don't say. Then they head inside the clubs and start logging what they see. At the Wild Orchid, an investigator watches as dancers pull a man on stage. It's his birthday, so they try to make a show of it. They take off his shirt and violently rip off his underwear. They whip his chest and back. He looks like he's in pain. Then a dancer blindfolds him and shoves a sex toy into his mouth. Over at Fantasy Girls, things get even more lewd, according to the report. The PIs see dancers so drunk or high, they can't keep their heads up. They watch three guys walk into a stall in the men's room and snort what they presume to be cocaine. At one point, a brawl breaks out between two groups of guys. Then the dancers jump into the fray too. No one calls the cops. The PI says he saw dancers on stage grind their bodies together and even perform oral sex on one another. One dancer reportedly sits on a man's face while he licks her. Another dancer asks the investigator if he wants to, and I quote, snort a line of blow off her ass. Over the course of the investigation, the dancers also try hard to get the PIs into a back room. Remember, the dancers make more money working in the back. But that's also where the really dirty stuff was supposedly taking place. The PI writes that he heard dancers talking about having sex in the back, but he didn't do the obvious. He didn't try to buy a lap dance or get into the back himself, because he didn't have approval to spend money on that. A lot of the activity the private eyes reported seeing in the clubs is technically illegal. Patrons aren't supposed to touch dancers, period. And dancers aren't supposed to touch each other's breasts or genitals. Oral sex on stage is definitely forbidden. But here's the thing. What the private eyes did not see was the really serious stuff. Prostitution, drug trafficking, sex trafficking. What they saw was troubling, even illegal, and it was definitely ammunition the city could put to use. But if Carl Hall or the city council was looking for a smoking gun, something that might sway public sentiment against Cammie, something to justify kicking strip clubs out of downtown, this didn't seem to be it. Cammie felt vindicated by the report.
So for me, I took it as a compliment. It's obvious that they don't have anything. So it's sad that you're wasting City of Reno resources on this, on bringing private investigators in to look at boobs. That's all it is. Yeah, there's boobs.
As for the illegal stuff, well, Cammie said the private eyes must have exaggerated. The person I really wanted to talk to, though, was Neoma Jardin, the city council member who first proposed a moratorium on new strip clubs, but then later voted against kicking strip clubs out of downtown. I wanted to know what she thought of the PI's report and whether the city was being too aggressive in its push to get rid of Cammie. I went to see Jardin at her office at City Hall. Reno City Hall looks like this giant Lego piece, a black glass and steel tower flanked by defunct hotel casinos. Jardin's office is on the 15th floor. It has a view over downtown, out to the mountains that frame the city's western edge. You can see the storms roll in from here. But you can also see the stretch of downtown that gentrification has missed. The empty Woolworths building, sketchy liquor stores and t-shirt shops. Jardin tells me that, in her opinion, this whole movement to kick out the strip clubs has gone too far. And she points the finger at Carl Hall's office.
You know, our legal department brought forward this ordinance to say, you know, if you're nonconforming, we do have a legal basis and background where we can move you into a conforming area. I did not support that, and I still, as I sit here today, don't support that strategy.
What do you think about the idea of the city hiring a private investigator to essentially spy on a private business?
That, to me, makes me a little itchy, and it makes me wonder, what was the rationale behind it?
I was still wondering the same thing. What was Carl Hall's rationale for hiring a private eye? Like I said before, Carl Hall won't explain any of this to me. But interviews aren't the only way to get information. We all have a paper trail. Carl Hall was a county prosecutor for nearly 26 years before he was elected Reno City Attorney in 2014. And elected officials like Carl Hall, they have to file financial disclosure forms, documents that list their assets and investments. Not a lot of people take the time to actually look at them, but these forms are important. They're supposed to provide transparency and prevent elected officials from making decisions that could benefit them financially. They also come in handy for reporters. I looked up Hall's form, and it showed he and his wife owned half a dozen properties in Reno. But there was something significant about one of them. It was a 9,000-square-foot office building in Midtown, just a block away from the Wild Orchid. Carl Hall and Cammie Kashmiri were basically neighbors. I dug further through property records and found that this building had been in Carl Hall's wife's family for decades. The couple inherited it in 2006. I also found that Carl Hall and his wife put this building on the market for $1.5 million in May 2017, just 4 months after he'd hired private eyes to snoop on the strip clubs. That meant that while Carl Hall's staff was arguing to the city council that strip clubs could lower the value of neighboring properties, Carl Hall was trying to sell a neighboring property. Carl Hall could potentially benefit from the same changes in Midtown that are now threatening not just Cammie, but also Velma Scholes and her neighbors. Hall's property sat on the market for almost 2 years. And just before the Reno City Council made its final decision on what to do with the clubs, the property sold for $1.25 million, about $250,000 less than the original asking price. Reno City Council members frequently disclose potential conflicts of interest and will even recuse themselves if the conflict is too great. Even if that conflict is on their financial disclosure form, they still have to stand up in a city council meeting and tell the public about the conflict. State law requires it, and it's actually Carl Hall's job to make sure they do it. That law applies to Carl Hall, too. Filling out a financial disclosure form isn't enough. And experts in government ethics I talked to said Carl Hall should have disclosed his potential conflict during the strip club debate. But when the council debated the strip clubs, Carl Hall never stood up to say, "Hey, just so you know, I own a building across the street from the Wild Orchid." Cammie's lawyer, Mark Thierman, was on a sailboat in Bermuda when I broke the news to him. I just discovered that Carl Hall owned an office building pretty much across the street from the Wild Orchid, and he just sold it in March for like $1.1 million. Did you know about?
Really?
Yeah.
No, I did not. So he had a self-interest in this whole thing.
I mean, it kind of looks like that.
Fantastic. Okay.
So you didn't know either?
I didn't know. Cammie knew?
No, Cammie didn't know.
What are you talking about?
Cammie didn't know. I didn't know.
So we have the city attorney going after a strip club that happens to be a block away from his lovely property that he thinks lowers the value of the property. Great. And he doesn't disclose any of this.
Most council members didn't know either. I reached Councilman Devin Reese by phone while he was waiting to catch a plane. Did you know that he had property a block away from the Wild Orchid?
Nope, that's first I've heard of that.
That's how most of my conversations with council members went. Only one, Jenny Breckus, knew Carl Hall owned the office building, and she only knew because she's super familiar with the neighborhood. Council members I talked to said they would have liked to have known about it, and they didn't understand why Carl Hall didn't disclose it in a public meeting. Here's Devin Reese again.
I just think it's important because as elected officials and handling sensitive subjects, the public really deserves to know the information, because otherwise what happens is, you know, it gets out through other means and people view it as something that should have been disclosed. And then it looks more nefarious than maybe it was, or looks like a motivating factor when maybe it wasn't. And again, I can't comment on either one of those because it wasn't disclosed to me.
I finally got Carl Hall on the phone this summer.
Carl.
Hey, Carl, it's Ann Jeanette.
Hey, Ann Jeanette.
He was in his city hall office toward the end of the day. I asked him again if he'd do an interview with me.
You know, I'm not really inclined to do that.
So I just launched into my questions about his property deal in Midtown. I mean, we'd just like to, I guess, understand why it wasn't disclosed during the process and, you know, if the whole
story... Why what? The fact that I own an office building, why that wasn't disclosed to who?
To the public.
It's a public record, right? I mean, what does that have to do with anything?
Well, it is public record, and it was on your financial disclosure form. But in my discussions with the experts on the state ethics law, elected officials are required to disclose potential conflicts of interest in a manner that is sufficient to inform the public. Similar to, you know, I think...
What's the conflict?
I guess owning a piece of property that could be affected by a decision that's before the city council and that your office was working to develop the policy on.
No, it didn't have anything to do with any work that I did on behalf of the city.
Okay. And you don't think... No. Something that would affect the future of the strip club could affect the value one way or the other of your property?
Nope.
Carl Hall is well-versed in the state's ethics law. He's the city attorney. He's at these meetings when council members make these kinds of disclosures. It's his job to tell them when to disclose. But when it comes to his property, he says he just doesn't see the conflict.
And I'm not trying to influence them one way or the other. I'm trying to defend their policy decisions. So.
Mm-hmm. But as, I mean, do you think council...
I don't have a dog in the fight.
Well, I guess some people might think you do if you own property real close to the club.
Well, not anymore.
Right, you sold it for a lot of money.
Yeah, I think you're trying to make something that's not there, so I'm sorry.
We went back and forth like this for a bit before wrapping up. And then he let me know he didn't appreciate my line of questioning.
Frankly, I'm a little offended. Frankly, I'm offended by that. So, but anyway.
When I later told Cammy about Carl Hall's building, he told me that suddenly everything made sense to him. He could never quite figure out why it seemed the city was out to get him.
I mean, come on. I mean, this is such a cornball, small town, corrupt politics.
To Cammy, Carl Hall's possible conflict of interest explained everything. But me, I wasn't so sure. Yeah, Carl Hall potentially stood to benefit if the clubs were kicked out of Midtown. But there were a lot of different people pushing for that to happen. He wasn't the only person with power, and he wasn't the only one who had stakes. And although the private eye hadn't found a smoking gun, the report didn't exactly exonerate Cammy either. The PI hadn't even been in the back room. So I still had a lot of questions about what really goes on in those strip clubs and about the effort to get rid of them. Even before he found out about Carl Hall's land deal, Cammy felt besieged. The private investigators, the accusations about drug and sex trafficking, government harassment at its worst, Cammy thought. And he wasn't going to sit back and take it. So in September 2017, the day after the council voted to oust his clubs, Cammy unleashed his lawyer. On its face, the federal lawsuit Mark Thierman filed against the city had little to do with the new ordinances. The suit accused the city of discriminating against women by putting more restrictions on female dancers than male review dancers. But in reality, Mark said the lawsuit was payback.
Well, they had this ordinance floating around. I didn't think it was going to get past, you know, that initial vote. I thought that was crazy. Then I said, fuck them. They want to see what war is, show what war is.
Next up, Anjanette goes looking for clues in Cammy's past that could explain why he's so combative. And she learns that his roots in old Reno explain a lot of his conflicts with new Reno. That's after the break.
The holidays will be here before you know it. And there's a new shopping destination where you can find all the gifts you need in one place, Verishop. Verishop is a new online shopping site with the brands you need for every moment in your life, from women's and men's fashion to home decor, beauty, and wellness. And they get your purchases to you fast with free one-day shipping and free returns with no membership fee and no minimum purchase required. The expert retail team at Verishop hand selects and sources every single item from the brands, so there's no chance of counterfeits or fake goods. They even give you the option to pay over time, and their customer care representatives are available 24/7 by phone, text, or email. Shop with Verishop for the fastest free shipping out there. As a listener of the city, you can take 15% off your first purchase to try it out. Just go to verishop.com/thecity and enter code THECITY at checkout. That's VERISHOP.com/thecity, code THECITY, for 15% off your first purchase. Exclusions apply.
With the plan to oust the strip clubs still very much on the table, the way Cammy saw it, his hometown had turned on him. In his eyes, he was a Hall of Fame athlete and a successful businessman. If anything, the city should be putting him on a pedestal. But Cammy had been knocked off that pedestal before. Anjanette picks it back up from here.
Here's your bag. Okay,
Paused.
It's a sunny day in April, the kind of day that makes you feel as if winter is over and spring has finally taken hold.
Hold off your fingers.
At Reno High School, classes have just let out for the day. More than 100 student athletes are milling about the track, waiting for practice to begin. Jumpers head to the north end of the track, sprinters line up in the middle, the distance runners set off for their circuit through the neighborhood. Over to the side of the track is a dusty shot put ring. Some of the brawniest students, both boys and girls, are lining up to take their turns, heaving a dense metal ball as far as they can. One boy crouches into the starting position, the shot resting in his hand near his cheek. He winds up for the throw, hops forward twice, whips his torso around, and thrusts the shot through the air.
Drive. No, I like the height, but you opened up. But you got the ball up in the air.
If that voice sounded familiar to you, it should. It's Cammy. Yes, in Reno, the strip club kingpin is also the assistant track coach at the local high school.
You guys, look, your bodies are dead. So we're just going to work on leg work. Okay, drive right through it. Just go. Left, down, rip. One movement. Okay, not bad. Attack.
Both Cammy and his brother Jamie have coached discus and shot put at their alma mater for years. As we're standing there, the head coach pulls up in his full-size pickup truck and sees me interviewing Cammy. He makes a beeline towards us. He wants me to know how much he likes Cammy.
It's an absolute pleasure to have Coach Cammy Cashmere here at Reno High School. The contribution he makes not only to the school, but giving back to the community is a huge asset, and we're thankful to have him here.
All right, Keegan, let's go.
This is the kind of adulation Cammy is used to. He's a hometown sports hero, a local boy made good in a place where being a local boy matters. Cammy runs the kids through their throwing drills. He lectures one kid who dropped his elbow on a throw.
Your arm hurts? Because you're dropping your elbow and you're throwing it like a baseball.
He'll hurt himself if he keeps doing that, he says. He advises another kid to use more torque. On the side, he complains to me about their lack of discipline in a grouchy, kids these days kind of way.
When I grew up, it was dedication, desire, and drive. The three Ds is what we grew up with. These kids, I'll take one of the three, you know? There you go. Much better. You see how that works? Feels good, doesn't it, when you get it right?
Cammy's coach growing up was his dad, an Olympic athlete from Iran. Cammy started discus when he was really young, like 9 years old. By the age of 23, he was throwing farther than anyone in the world. And in 1992, Cammy was just a step away from competing in the Olympics himself. Back in his office at the Ponderosa, I asked Cammy to tell me more about his glory days. His office is actually more like a storage room, overflowing with file boxes and a ratty couch. There are no medals or trophies, no framed magazine covers. Cammy tells me that growing up, he thought his dad was invincible. He was a mountain of a man with a thick mustache who hoped his son would follow in his athletic footsteps.
Iran was kind of exotic. Ooh, that's kind of a cool place. Far away. People in Reno didn't understand, you know, much about Iran. So my dad would come to class, you know, because the Olympics, everybody knew the Olympics. They didn't know much about Iran. So it was kind of like people were not in awe of that a little bit.
That changed in 1979. Cammy was 10 years old when a group of Iranian college students seized the U.S. Embassy in Tehran in what became known as the Iran hostage crisis.
You know, these kids were turning on me. Your dad competes for a country that, you know, represents terrorists. So, you know, I had kids bully me, you know, in school. I mean, it was like, I was normal. Every day I'd get into a fight with somebody else. What I did was, so my dad's like, well, you learn to fight back. And I guess in a lot of ways it motivated me, and I worked out a lot harder, and I ended up being the biggest kid, and everybody left me alone. So it was kind of nice being the biggest kid in school.
Hearing this helped me start to understand Cammy a little better. So did what he told me next about his rise to superstar athlete and his subsequent fall. In 1987, his senior year, Cammie broke the national high school discus record. The Nevada governor proclaimed June 22, 1987, Cammie Kashmiri Day. Gatorade named him track and field athlete of the year, which is a big deal in the world of high school sports. Emmitt Smith, who would go on to become a star NFL running back, won the same award that year. When Cammie was in college at the University of Nevada, he won 3 NCAA discus titles. By this point in his life, it was Cammie in the newspapers, not his dad. I pulled an old story from the Reno Gazette Journal and read Cammie the lead.
All right. He says, the best young discus thrower of all time doesn't walk through Flex Fitness Gym in South Reno. He floats. His hair is teased and moosed so it stands on end, hardened like fingers of black licorice. He wears coal-colored spandex tights streamlined to his rocky thighs like a corset.
Very good writing there. That's good stuff.
Is that how you see yourself?
I mean, I don't see myself that way. I mean, you know, you're a young guy. You know, when I was competing, I was 300 pounds. I was a big boy. I was strong. So, yeah, maybe I stood out in the gym.
But Cammie's athletic glory was cut short. In 1992, he won the U.S. Olympic trials with a throw more than 4 feet longer than the guy who came in second. They hung a gold medal around his neck. He was headed to the Olympics in Barcelona. He would represent his country, just like his dad wanted. But then his mom called.
So I win the trials, right? And literally, I get a call from my mom saying I got a FedEx thing for the drug test that says I failed or whatever.
His pre-competition drug test came back positive for steroids. Cammie never competed in the Olympics. A guy from Lithuania won the gold that year with a throw almost 20 feet shorter than Cammie's all-time best. In Cammie's eyes, he was the victim of a conspiracy, the details of which are too convoluted to get into here. He said he routinely did uppers during competition, excessive amounts of caffeine, for instance, but he never did anything illegal. Cammie fought this suspension for a while, but eventually gave up his appeals. They banned him from the sport for life. But talking to me today, Cammie waves that part off. He says he had already made the decision that 1992 would be his last year throwing.
And I knew at that point I was done. For me, it was over. So, you know, it was meant to be. Like I said, that God didn't want me to do it. And thank God, because my dad would have paraded me around as his Olympic champion's son. And I would literally throw until my arm fell off.
As Cammie tells me his life story, I can't help but think that he seems to run in these cycles of adulation and excoriation. He's popular because his dad's an Olympian, then he's bullied because he's Iranian. He's a hometown hero for his athletic prowess, then he's branded a cheater. He's a respected local businessman, then he's a smut-peddling scourge of New Reno. As he sees it, each time it's the powers that be trying to screw him out of what he worked so hard to achieve. And each time, Cammie turns toward the fight. The bullies beat him up, he gets stronger. The city comes after his club, he readies for battle.
My father had a sign over his office, when life kicks you, it kicks you forward. That was his motto. So they want to push this. I really feel that the city's on the wrong end of this, and we're going to end up getting more.
Cammie presents himself as a victim, standing up to bullies, as a righteous warrior fighting against the city. But next up, Cammie shows he's willing to use his own desperate tenants in the service of that fight. After the break, Cammie unleashes Velma and her neighbors.
Life is full of challenges, big and small. Sometimes we all need a little help working our way through what the world throws at us. And that is where BetterHelp comes in. BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist who you can start communicating with in under 24 hours. This is not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It's professional counseling done securely online. You can log into your account anytime and send a message to your counselor, and you'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions, so you won't ever have to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room like you would with traditional therapy. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy to change counselors if needed. Visit BetterHelp.com/thecity. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P, and join the over 500,000 people taking charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. Listeners of The City get 10% off your first month by going to BetterHelp.com/thecity.
When Cammie stuck that letter on Velma's door, he knew that the city council had been under pressure to do something about the lack of affordable housing in Reno. So you could argue that it was a shrewd move to threaten his tenants with a rent increase while blaming it on the city. It was Cammie's way of showing that if city officials came after his clubs, they wouldn't just be hurting him. Let's go back to Anjanette.
24th meeting of the Reno City Council. Our first order of business is the Pledge of Allegiance. And if we could get Tammy...
It's January 2018, about 4 months after the City Council approves the plan to start ousting the strip clubs. And I'm back at City Hall for a routine council meeting. To be honest, I'm expecting a dull affair. Strip clubs aren't even on the agenda. But just as the meeting is getting underway, about 24 people file into the room. Some are young and look to be blue-collar workers. A couple of others are in wheelchairs. There's an elderly man in a frayed sports coat, his hair pomaded into place. Many have weathered faces. This is the pack of Ponderosa residents that Velma Scholes has wrangled to City Hall to fight for their homes.
Velma Scholes, followed by Warren Brown, followed by Jay Williams.
Yes, my name's Velma Scholes, and I've been at Ponderosa for almost 5 years, 6 years, my granddaughter.
At 4'8", she's barely taller than the lectern before her. Her graying auburn hair is pulled back in an elastic band, and her chin is set as she faces the council members.
This has been a home for my granddaughter since elementary school, and we don't want that taken from us. Please don't take that from us.
Shortly before the council meeting, Velma had seen the letter on her door. And this confrontation, this is exactly what Cammie wanted. Remember, he'd encouraged his tenants to reach out to their elected officials. He'd even given them names and phone numbers.
We really need we need this hotel more than anything in the world right now. Not just me, but other families. I'm not the only family raising kids there.
Cammie's gambit with the letter had scared the hell out of the people living in his hotel.
I mean, they was there when I had nobody, when I had no one and nowhere to turn. That hotel gave me a place to live, a bed to sleep in, and a way to cook for my granddaughter when I was homeless, going from couch to couch. I mean, please don't take that from us. Just do the best you can to help us save that. I would appreciate that. Thank you very much. Thank you.
It's clear that Velma and the other hotel residents don't blame Cammie for any of this. They blame the Reno City Council. But Councilwoman Neoma Jardin tries to turn their attention back to the guy threatening to double their rent.
Thank you very much. I hope the owners see what this tactic has done in scaring you and making you cry at the podium and worry about the roof over your head. I hope they are watching today.
She sees Cammie's move with the letter as a political ploy.
It's a disgusting tactic, and they're using you as their mechanism and pawn. And I haven't seen the letter, but it concerns me greatly that you guys are here today out of your busy days, scared, and it's an unfortunate tactic that I find offensive and, frankly, not effective. So I just wanted to let you know our side from the city council. So, Madam Clerk, next speaker.
Okay, let me take a step back here. Even without the strip club fight, the threat to the Ponderosa residents is real as Reno changes around them. An influx of tech workers has helped push Reno's housing prices to record heights. When Ponderosa residents confronted city council members, Reno's median house price was $370,000,
That's up from $135,000 in 2012. Meanwhile, the average wage in Reno is just $46,000 a year. Apartment vacancy rates are near zero. Investors are coming in and scooping up apartment buildings, jacking up the rent, or even evicting tenants to make it easier to remodel. Landlords once partnered with caseworkers to rent to people who needed help. Now they're renting to Tesla workers. The waitlist for housing assistance is so long, officials have stopped taking new names entirely. People are living out of their cars or in tents along the Truckee River, which runs through downtown. Reno's only homeless shelter is so overcrowded that a man recently died from hypothermia after he was trapped on the roof. His body lay there for days before he was found. And the Weeklies, the motels where people like Velma pay to live, those are disappearing too, even though they're home to 4,000 people who have nowhere else to go. In fact, Councilwoman Jardin has been a huge proponent of old motel demolitions. She even posed for a photo op, sitting astride a bulldozer sent to clear the land of one. This is why Cammy's note on his tenants' doors was so damn frightening. When Velma says she has nowhere else to go if she loses her home at the Ponderosa, she's right. I wanted to better understand their situation, so I went to visit one day last July. When I arrive, a group of people are lounging in the front of the Ponderosa Hotel, trying to escape the heat in their rooms. Children are playing with a deflated soccer ball between the cars in the carport. As I stroll up to the front door, a guy sees my mic and he launches into this animated monologue about how he could use ammonia to rid the Ponderosa of all of its bed bugs.
I've only been here a few days and I got totally chewed by bugs. We're going to eradicate it without Raid. We're going to do it with ammonia. Keep people healthy.
I start chatting with another guy. He's standing on two prosthetic legs and he says he's trying to find a better place to live. But when landlords find out he lives at the Ponderosa Hotel, they don't want to take him because they're afraid he's going to bring bedbugs with him. Inside, I discover that the Ponderosa's poor reputation, it's been earned. That noise is the elevator. You can hear it grinding away from far down the hall. Residents I spoke with said it constantly breaks down, sometimes leaving people who are in wheelchairs stranded for hours in the lobby or upstairs in hallways. I step out of the elevator and onto the fourth floor. Half the light bulbs are missing, and the ones that are still working, they're flickering almost like a strobe light. There's enough light to see a cockroach scoot down the wall to my left. Velma's place is at the far end of the hall. She invites me into the room she's been living in with her 16-year-old granddaughter, Taylor, for 7 years. She's done a great job of turning this hotel room into a comfortable living space.
Well, it's got a, you know, it's got a living area here. It's got two beds in it. I could have a table and chairs if I wanted. I do have the table.
Living in her small room at the Ponderosa is far better than the 2 years she spent homeless and couch surfing in California.
She's like, I'm going to have to move. Where? Where am I going? I don't have money to move. So I've got Taylor. What am I going to do with her? The river? That's the next best thing, the river.
And beyond having her own place, Velma has carved out an important role for herself at the hotel. She's a de facto leader here. She marches up and down the halls, gripping her oversized cell phone by the poppet glued to the back. She checks in on her neighbors, makes sure people have food. She picks up any trash she sees along the way.
We've got a little man that just moved in a couple of doors over. He's lived here before, but he was homeless, so I told him I would fix him a little box of stuff and bring to him. Some of us, we just kind of look out for one another.
I ask if I can meet her neighbors, and she insists that I meet her buddy John down the hall.
Knock, knock.
She announces me as the news, and initially, John wants nothing to do with me. But he's no match for Velma's relentlessness, and he ultimately invites me inside.
We live here. This is my home. I'm proud of my home, you know? I mean, look. I love my home. I live all by myself, but I keep a nice, clean house, and I'm a happy camper, and I like it.
John's health is fragile. For years, he worked at a plant nursery until heart attacks and seizures made working impossible.
His room isn't any bigger than Velma's, but he chose it because of the view from his fourth floor window.
I love this view. I sit here in the morning, I have my coffee, I say my prayers, and you know, it's excellent. It's a great way to wake up every morning. I can see from the very far east to the very far west, and I sit 60, 70 feet above the city. And so my view is an entire open view of the entire south of Reno.
The city is spread out before John's window, the lively restaurants and bars along Virginia Street, the valley full of trees and houses beyond Midtown, the ski runs carved into the mountain range in the distance. You can see why developers would want to build high-priced condos here. John has watched Reno change from this window. The weekly motel across the parking lot is now market-rate condos. Yoga shops and fancy cocktail bars have opened up around him. He used to watch tourists stream out of downtown hotel casinos. Now he sees people leaving their hotel rooms to catch a ride out to their new jobs at Tesla.
I've seen the entire crew marching every morning out of Harrah's and out of Circus and marching over, getting on the shuttles to get bussed out to the gigafactories, Tesla, Panasonic, so on.
If these changes forced the Ponderosa to close, like Velma, John would have nowhere else to go. Cammy's letter sparked panic among his tenants, but it also brought into stark relief the real stakes in this fight over what the new Reno should be. Council members celebrate motel demolitions as progress, all the while taking on this fight with the strip clubs, which in the end could make the affordable housing crisis even worse for the city's most vulnerable residents. So while Cammy may be the one scaring his tenants with threats of rent hikes, he says he's not the real villain.
They want to make me look like the bad guy. Who's the bad guy? You're the one who wants to kick the... I didn't start this war. The truth of the matter is you're the one kicking these people out. You're the one creating this. Not me. So you can lie to everybody and spin it to bad Kashmiri, but the reality is Mr. Kashmiri's been doing a service for this town a long time and helping these poor people out. That's the truth.
Velma and John aren't the only people caught up in a fight that threatens their stability. While Cammy was busy orchestrating a dramatic confrontation between Ponderosa residents and the Reno City Council, the city was quietly deploying a weapon of its own. The cops are about to show up on Cammy's doorstep. But just like with Velma and John, he's not the only one who will suffer the consequences.
I was just like, I knew I didn't do anything wrong. So I was just like, I don't understand how I could be in this situation. Like, why me? Like, it's
really, oh gosh, I'm sorry.
It's okay. It's not, it's just, I don't know why that happened to me.
Yeah. No, it's not, you got caught. Like, you got caught in something a lot bigger that has nothing to do with you.
Yeah, because I didn't do anything wrong. And I'm just like, it sucks that they had to use me, like, as a pawn for whatever's going on between them and the city. Like, that's not right. Like, you're ruining people's lives.
That's next time on The City. The City is a production of USA Today and is distributed in partnership with Wondery. You can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. If you like the show, please rate and review us, and be sure to tell your friends about us. Our show was reported and produced by Anjanette Damon, Phil Corbett, Camille Stanley, Taylor Macon, and me, Robin Amer. Our editors are Amy Pyle and Matt Doig. Ben Austin is our story consultant. Original music and mixing is by Hannes Brown. Legal review by Tom Curley. Launch oversight by Shannon Green. Additional production by Emily Liu, Sam Greenspan, Wilson Sayer, and Jenny Casas. Brian Dugan is the Reno Gazette Journal's executive editor. Chris Davis is the USA Today Network's VP for Investigations. Scott Stein is our VP of Product, and our president and publisher is Maribel Wadsworth. special thanks to Liz Nelson, Kelly Scott, and Alicia Barber. I'm Robin Amer. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at The City Pod, or visit our website, that's thecitypodcast.com.